I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. All four presidential candidates are in Texas today in advance of Tuesday's crucial primaries in Texas and Ohio. On the Republican side, John McCain has an apparently unbeatable lead, but his long-shot challenger, Mike Huckabee, is now asking whether McCain will have to put his campaign on hold until after the Republican convention because of federal rules about spending limits in the primary season. On the Democratic side, Tuesday's contests are seen as must-wins for Senator Hillary Clinton. The polls show the race tightening in both Texas and Ohio, states where Clinton had enjoyed commanding leads until recently. We're joined now by John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for the New York Times. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Let's start with the Democrats. Ohio and Texas now seen as must wins for Senator Clinton. She's lost a string of 11 primaries in a row to Barack Obama. How does she appear to you as she heads into this final crucial weekend?
She's in a heap of trouble. Mm. She needs to win both states by the profession of no less than her husband, former President Clinton. In Texas, public polls would tell you that Barack Obama has caught Hillary Clinton, raised her lead. In Ohio, a close race. She still seems to have a slight lead when you look at most of the public opinion polls. And so the question then would be, what's good enough for her to keep going in this race? Mm. She's behind in delegates. She's not likely, even if she wins both narrowly, to make up much ground in the delegate race. But if she's able to win the popular vote in both places, she'll have an argument for going on. If she doesn't, it's pretty tough.
Mm. Now, she's been pushing this idea of experience, and the campaign just unveiled a new ad. I guess it features, I haven't seen it, but I've read about it. It features a child sleeping and an emergency phone in the White House ringing. And I guess the message is we need a president who is tested and ready. That's the message she's been putting out there for a while. It seems not to be working as well as she would like it. Is she going to make some kind of change here in these final days?
Well, that message hasn't worked so far. She sharpens the message with this advertisement. It's a very well made political ad. And it raises valid objections that Hillary Clinton has offered against Barack Obama. His answer, of course, which is also, it strikes me as a fairly effective answer, is, they have the ringing telephone in the advertisement, which I did see this morning, and Barack Obama says, yes, she's had her red phone moment, and when she answered the phone, she said we should go to war in Iraq, and that was a bad judgment. And what voters are going to have to decide on is who's got the right judgment on foreign policy. They're both staking out their positions. If you look at the evidence of recent primaries, he's got the high side of that argument, but we'll see on Tuesday.
Mm. In terms of money, the Clinton campaign announced that it raised $35 million in February, which is pretty good. That's more than twice what she took in the month before. But I gather Senator Obama is expected to do even better.
$35 million, it shows you the great inflation we're experiencing now, is an astonishing total.
Mm.
And in any other campaign, it would be record-setting and would cause people to sort of drop their jaws in wonder. But Barack Obama has the most powerful financial engine we've ever seen. He's going to raise a lot more money than her, more than double in January. I don't know that he's going to double her this time, but very impressive total. And if you look on the ground in Ohio and Texas, he is far outspending her by 2-to-1 margins on television ads. So again, she's really behind the eight ball in terms of where she stands in this race. And I tell you what, if she can, against these odds, his momentum, his money, and the kind of national wave behind him, if she can win these two primaries, that is a real show of strength on her part and would justify her staying in.
Mm. Well, let's switch over to the Republicans and stick with money. John McCain wants to switch out of federal financing, and his opponents say he can't do that. What's the issue here?
The issue is that John McCain was flat broke in mid 2007. He was unable to raise substantial amounts of money against what looked like formidable competitors in Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani, among others, Fred Thompson as well. So he filed for federal matching funds. Now, by the time it came to get that money, he did not need it. Mm. He was doing better, and so he never received the money. And now the question is, can he, on his own volition, opt out of the system? The argument that he can't is that he used federal funds, the promise of federal funds as collateral to get a bank loan, which is what ended up floating his campaign financially until he started winning. He says it wasn't collateral, and the critics and opponents, and you can bet the Democratic Party is going to aggressively continue making this argument, is that if he didn't use it as collateral, he got a sweetheart deal on the loan, and that's something we're going to be talking about for a while. But if he is unable to opt out of the system, he could potentially be under severe constraints both this spring and summer and in the fall.
And how big a liability would that be for him if he essentially had to slow down or suspend his campaign for a while?
Huge liability, because he's almost already near the cap in what you can spend under that system. That means his campaign would have to, other than assistance they would get from outside groups, which they legally couldn't coordinate with, would have to go dark between now and the conventions in late summer. Barack Obama has the ability to raise tremendous amounts of money if he emerges as the likely nominee. Hillary Clinton could as well, and they could campaign against him all summer. Then you get to the question of the fall, where it could get very interesting, and that is that McCain's arguing Barack Obama promised to join him in restricting themselves to taxpayer funds for the fall. It's now clear that Barack Obama could raise multiples of what those taxpayer funds would be, and the question is, does he keep to his promise and restrict himself, or does he cash in on the kind of financial advantage Democrats haven't seen in a long time?
Thanks,
very,
John.
Very tough choice for Barack Obama.
Thanks for following the story for us. That's John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times. The price of crude oil hit record highs this week, flirting with $103 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Soaring energy prices are bringing new attention to the nation's most abundant natural resource, coal. So we're going to spend the next few minutes talking about so-called clean coal technology. In a moment, a Harvard energy expert will weigh in on the feasibility of this technology. But first, we're joined by one of its biggest boosters, Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me in.
Well, now, without losing us in too much technical detail, I'm intrigued about this idea of clean coal power plants. You've been pushing them for some time. How do they work?
We're not proposing using coal in the way we had in the past. In fact, the coal technology that we're talking about doesn't even include a smokestack.
So how does that work?
Look, here's what we're proposing. Yeah. It's called coal gasification. And instead of having a smokestack and burning the coal and letting the bad stuff go up the smokestack, think of a big thermos jug that's 40 feet in diameter and 100 feet high. And then open the top of this thermos jug and dump in 30 ton of coal, just black coal. And then at the bottom of this thermos jug, introduce some heat. And so that what you do is you heat the coal and increase the pressure, and the gas actually leaves the coal. And that gas will be natural gas, a methane gas, and CO2. As the gas rises to the top, you can separate the pure methane from the pure CO2. The methane is natural gas. You can send it to your house and make a meal with it or heat your house. You can generate electricity with it, or you can actually make fertilizers or even liquid fuel from it. If you're able to separate the pure CO2, then you can pump it right back into the earth. And what I'm saying is that for the last 50 years, the oil industry has actually been using pure CO2, and they pump that CO2 into the geologic rocks that contain oil. It forces the oil out of the rock and increases oil production. It's called enhanced oil recovery. But this technology that we're developing, if, for example, we run out of places to pump that CO2 into oil-bearing rock, then you would pump it into other kinds of rocks that are just have vacant space like a big sponge. That's called carbon sequestration. Pump it back into the earth for storage for the next 10,000 years. Mm.
But aren't these projects, you've described the technology, and I know the technology exists, but in terms of building it on a big enough level to produce plants that actually make a difference, I mean, we're still talking about something in the testing stage in the U.S., aren't we?
It's interesting because this technology was developed in the 30s, and the Germans used it during World War II as a source of energy, and the South Africans have been using it for the last 40 years.
Then why isn't it widespread here, though?
Because energy has been very cheap until very recently. Natural gas was $1.50, $2. This coal gasification, if you were just to convert coal to natural gas, it costs about $5 per MCF. And until very recently, natural gas was worth $3, $2, $1.50. And the other problem we have is simply this. We haven't developed a CO2 strategy in this country. Sure. If you are a person who's getting ready to build an electrical generating plant, it's a heck of a lot cheaper for you to deploy the technology that we developed 100 years ago with the smokestack. And we don't have a federal government right now that considers CO2 such a pollutant that we're going to charge you if you put it into the atmosphere. And so until we have a carbon cap and trade system like they do in Europe, or some kind of a carbon technology fee that we'll charge you some money if you put CO2 in the atmosphere, we are sending the wrong market signals to those who generate electricity. I think a negative cost associated with putting CO2 in the atmosphere and use 100% of it as a technology fee, it'll be good for the economy, it'll be good for the environment.
Scientific American noted last year that this kind of technology would produce roughly twice the global warming emissions of gasoline, and in effect could make global warming worse, not better. Any truth to that?
Absolutely, if you don't sequester the CO2.
If you don't sequester.
Look, it means deploying these technologies so that this abundant supply of coal we have. We have more coal than any other country in the world. In fact, we have more coal in Montana alone as BTUs than Saudi Arabia does oil. So we have coal. The problem with coal is it puts twice as much carbon in the atmosphere per unit of energy as oil, and about three times as much as natural gas. But if we deploy this sequestration technology, effectively what we're doing is removing the carbon and we put it right back in the earth where it came from.
Another problem, and that is cost. The National Resources Defense Council pointed out that to build one of these plants could cost as much as $4 billion. For that amount, it was pointed out that you could offer every driver in Montana $4,000 toward a hybrid car and build a small nuclear plant.
Well, listen, if you want to build a refinery today, it's $5 or $6 billion. If you want to build a traditional pulverized coal plant with a smokestack, it's going to be a couple of billion dollars. If you want to build a wind farm, it's going to be $1 billion. So these big generation projects, of which I support clean coal technology, wind power, solar power, they all cost a lot of money.
You mentioned that Montana is a huge coal producer, so some might see you as a governor of a big coal-producing state pushing clean coal and say, well, that figures.
Well, it does figure, but the bottom line is that we have a problem with dirty coal. And the problem is that 49 or 50% of our entire electricity portfolio is with this coal. I don't want to build any more of these coal plants. I don't want to build a coal plant that continues to put the bad stuff in the air. That's why I'd like to deploy this new technology, replace the existing portfolio, and of course, I support nukes as well. I got to tell you, if we're going to produce the electricity that we need in this country to replace foreign oil and decrease greenhouse gases, nukes are going to be part of the solution. Natural gas, part of the solution. Wind power, solar power, tidal, all of them part of the solution. But we import 4 billion barrels of oil per year. I want a clean, green, domestic energy supply.
Well, Governor, thanks so much for coming in and talking about this with us today.
You bet. It was good to be here.
Much appreciated. That's Brian Schweitzer. He's the Democratic governor of Montana. So Governor Schweitzer says the U.S. can move towards clean coal. When we come back, we'll speak to an energy expert about the feasibility of clean coal technologies. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about alternative energy sources today and whether the nation's abundant supplies of coal can go from a dirty source of energy to a clean one. I'm joined now by Henry Lee, director of the Environment and Natural Resources Program at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Okay, we just heard from Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer describe technology that can extract clean-burning methane from coal and pump the polluting CO2 back into the ground. We get the energy we need, no greenhouse gases. How realistic is this?
Well, there are two parts to this. One, you have to be able to capture the carbon dioxide off the back end of a coal to liquids or a coal-fired electric generating plant. You got to transport it, and then you've got to basically put it in the ground. The hardest part of this is the capture. That's basically 85% of the cost. Mm-hmm. Right now, we only have 3 small demonstration projects in the world, in Canada, Algeria, and Norway, to basically put the carbon dioxide back in the ground. Secondly, we don't know about the liability problems. What happens if it leaks out? What happens if it contaminates the groundwater? And thirdly, we have not been able to build these at a commercial level. So all we know is at a small scale level, these seem to work. We don't know what the cost is for a commercial size facility, but the early price estimates we're getting from the oil industry, which has been doing this to enhance the recovery of oil, are quite high.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, do we have any idea? I mean, for example, do we know how much per barrel would the coal to liquid fuel cost? Any idea at all?
Yeah, we have some estimates, and there have been studies. A lot of the studies that are quoted in the press are 2 to 3 years out of date. Our figures, the studies we do, are about $75 a barrel right now, maybe a little bit higher. If you're going to capture it, probably you have to add about $15 to that.
So not cheap.
Not cheap, no.
Not cheap. And what about this idea of carbon sequestration? This notion of pumping the CO2 underground, do we really have the means to alter nature like this, use the earth as a sponge to safely soak up CO2 emissions?
Well, that's why I said we have to do more demonstrations on this. You've got to remember, you're pumping it into different geological formations, so they're not all the same. The two issues you worry about, the first and the foremost, is that this carbon dioxide will get into the groundwater and will contaminate the water. The second is that it will leak out, and if it leaks out in high concentrations, it could have substantial health problems. So far in the three demos, we have seen no leakage, but those are three little demos. If we do this on a bigger scale, there are some uncertain issues, some certain concerns, and the big problem is nobody is going to insure it, and nobody's going to finance it until you answer those concerns and you set up a regulatory regime that can oversee this.
And that's, in fact, the governor mentioned that there is no sort of CO2 policy right now. So the federal government really have to get involved in terms of some regulatory structure here.
Yes, definitely, and we don't have it at the moment.
How much is the federal government supporting the development of clean coal technology?
Well, the government put most all of its effort into a project called FutureGen, and for 4 years it was the only basically play in town in Washington in this area. It looks as if that project has fallen by the wayside, and there are provisions in the bill that was passed in December to push the government to finance three demonstrations around the country. And that, I think, is a good step, but it's a step they probably ought to have taken 5 years ago.
You mentioned FutureGen, this project. What was that precisely?
FutureGen was a large project to take coal and to gasify it and then to take the synthetic gas and turn it into hydrogen and to capture and sequester the carbon. It was a large, state-of-the-art kind of facility. The price kept going higher and higher every year, and finally both the private and the public parties decided it was just too expensive.
So finally, and the sort of bottom line question, I guess, how far away are we from moving to full-scale domestic energy production using clean coal technology along the lines that Governor Schweitzer described, in your view?
Well, I think you have to have about 3 years of demonstrations. You've got to set up a regulatory apparatus, and you've got to get some control on the price. I think for a large commercial development, we would be 10 years away, given, and this is very important, given the a legislative initiative in this country to put a price on carbon. So, and that price is going to have to be very high if this is going to move very quickly. It's going to be about $45 a ton of carbon, which will increase the price of conventional coal facility, electricity from conventional coal facility, by almost 80%.
And when you say putting a price on carbon, you're talking about actually charging for the emission of carbon into the atmosphere. Is that what you mean?
What I mean by that is you either go to a cap-and-trade regime like you have for sulfur that sets a price for sulfur. You got that right now. You do this for carbon, or you put a carbon tax. I think you'll probably do the former. You'll probably do the cap-and-trade, and you've got to have a price. But the price is rather significant. I think it's going to be somewhere, I think the lowest I've seen is around $35 a ton of carbon dioxide, or $100 a ton of carbon, all the way up to $150 a ton of carbon in order for this to happen.
Well, I think what I take away from this and all discussions, sort of sensible discussions about the energy future, is none of this is going to come for free. There's no silver bullet. We're going to have to probably pay more for energy in the future.
I think that's exactly right, and I think that's a hard thing for the American public and the political establishment to accept. They want the magic bullet. They want to have the solution, but they don't have to pay very much for it.
Okay. Well, Henry Lee, thanks very much for putting this into perspective today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Henry Lee, director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Program at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Here's what Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said this week about the unfolding mortgage crisis. "I'm not interested in bailing out investors, lenders, and speculators." Paulson's no bailout comment came in response to various proposals to help homeowners and stabilize credit markets in the wake of a crisis that could result in as many as 2 million foreclosures this year. Both the House and the Senate are considering a number of measures to help troubled homeowners, including a plan for the government to buy out failing mortgages and change bankruptcy laws. While the debate continues about what to do, our guest today says a bailout is already underway. John Cassidy writes the monthly economics column for Condé Nast Portfolio. And John Cassidy, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me on.
You write, and I'm just going to quote one line, "Even as the administration has stuck to its laissez-faire stance in public, a covert bailout is underway." What are you referring to?
Well, I'm referring to several things. While Paulson has been saying this publicly, various arms of the government and sort of quasi-arms of the government have been quietly extending a lot of money to the banking system. The most obvious one is the Federal Reserve Board, which has introduced a new type of a lending program, which it calls a term auction facility, which allows banks that are stuck with all these bad loans in mortgage securities to give them to the Federal Reserve in return for money. So it frees up cash and prevents them getting into serious trouble. Mm. That's one arm of it, the Fed. The second is something called the Federal Home Loan Bank System, which is a set of regional banks. And that's been lending a lot of money to firms like Citigroup and Washington Mutual that have been getting into trouble. And the third leg of it is the government-sponsored entities, as they're called, an ugly phrase, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are big publicly sponsored mortgage companies. And they've also been buying up a lot of mortgages, which, you know, wouldn't otherwise have any demand for them. All those three things, in my opinion, amount to a sort of indirect bailout. It's not a direct bailout of the sort that some of the Democrats are now calling for, although I think we may have pending going in that direction. But it's certainly not the sort of free market solution which Paulson is publicly espousing.
Mm. But well, let's talk about a couple of these. I'm intrigued in particular, first, the auctions through which the Federal Reserve Bank lent,
right,
$100 billion to financial firms. Where does that money come from, and how unusual a step is this?
Well, the Fed does lend, you know, and one of the jobs of the Fed is to lend to banks when they're in distress. But what was happening last summer when the banks were getting in a lot of trouble, they didn't want to lend from the Fed because they might have been seen as stigmatized and they thought it might lead to a panic. What happened has happened in Europe on a couple of occasions is banks have revealed that they were lending from the government and other lenders then think they're in serious trouble and it leads to a panic. So that's one reason. The other reason that people weren't lending from the Fed is because the Fed used to demand top rate securities as collateral. Now, what the crucial thing that has changed is the Fed now allows the banks to borrow on the basis of junk, basically mortgage securities for which nobody else will take off their hands. So if you're Citigroup or Merrill Lynch or somebody, not Merrill Lynch actually, but if you're Citigroup or JP Morgan and you're stuck with all these soured mortgages on your balance sheet, which nobody else will take off you because there's no market for them anymore, you can take them to the Federal Reserve and they'll give you, you know, cash in return for them. Mm. So it basically is a way for the Fed to inject a lot of money into the banking system.
Early in your article, you quote John Kenneth Galbraith, who famously said, "The only respectable form of socialism is socialism for the rich." Is that going on here? I mean, is it your contention that the big banks and lending institutions are getting away with something here that millions of distressed homeowners are not?
Well, at the moment they are. I mean, I think it looked for a while as if it was going to be a sort of alliance of the rich and the poor because it looked like there was going to be a bailout of, you know, the actual Paul Enders as well, although that doesn't seem to have happened. I mean, it sort of confirms Galbraith's quip in a way. The things which have gone through are the bailouts for the banks, but the proposals to bail out the distressed lenders, the actual homeowners, are stuck in Congress. So I think it just shows that Galbraith was actually right on that one.
But is it really a bailout? I mean, let me try to push back here a little bit. I mean, mechanisms
sure.
like the Fed lowering interest rates, even these auctions, actions by
yep.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I mean, aren't they just doing what the system is designed to have them do? And in this case, it's to step in and ensure that the financial system stays liquid and afloat.
Well, I mean, that's the Fed. You could make that argument for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are supposed to. They were set up to provide home loans to poor lenders to make home ownership more affordable for for individuals, middle class individuals. I don't think that this really comes under that rubric. The federal home loan bank system, I don't think most people realize exists. And yet, it's been sending out 180 odd billion. But sure, I mean, it becomes a matter of semantics. Is it a bailout or is it a lending operation?
Yeah.
Well, it's a lending operation. Basically, my definition of a bailout is the government providing money to the banks as they couldn't otherwise get. And it seems to me that's what's happening. I'm not necessarily saying it's a terrible thing. I'm not criticizing
sure.
it as a sort of moral thing. It's just, it's something going on which most people haven't noticed. And, the Bush administration and the Fed are not advertising this fact.
Well, call it what you may, bailout or not, the government, there's certainly a precedent for this. I mean, the government, we can look at Chrysler, we can look at the savings and loan banks
no, sure.
two decades ago.
The argument I make in the piece is that when you get a big financial crisis of this nature, private sector solutions usually don't work, and eventually the government, which is the sort of lender of the last resort or the buyer of the last resort, is forced to step in. And in fact, if you look at the history of financial crises over the last 30 or 40 years, it's very hard to spot one which wasn't actually stopped, which of its own accord, before the government stepped in. As you say, the savings and loans crisis is a classic example. It took the setting up of the Resolution Trust Corporation, which spent about $130 billion, if I remember correctly, to bring this to an end. And it actually did a pretty good job. And it seems to me that the sort of logic of the situation is heading towards that, especially if the credit crisis worsens, which it seems to be doing.
Mm. And what do you see as the long-term consequences, though, I mean, of this kind of action by the government?
Well, the long-term consequences, I would imagine, will include a sort of return to stricter regulation of the banks. What usually happens is you get a period of deregulation and the politicians take their hands off the tiller. Then you get a big blow-up and the taxpayer has to bail out these institutions. And then there's political pressure to, regulate them more tightly. I mean, ultimately, this lending crisis was a failure of oversight and regulation, the mortgage crisis, which underpins it all. People were getting mortgages who had no right to get mortgages, and banks were lending in an incredibly irresponsible manner. And, it's the job of the regulators and the Federal Reserve to stop that happening, and they didn't do it in this case. So I think in the long term, there'll be pressure for a lot more, or significantly more regulation of the financial system, and I think that would probably be a good thing.
John Cassidy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's John Cassidy. He writes the monthly economics column at Condé Nast Portfolio. And a heads up on some of the stories we'll be following next week. We'll look back at the campaign of terror against blacks and their white Republican allies by enraged Southern Democrats during Reconstruction following the Civil War. And we'll hear from musician Grace Kelly. She's just 15, but she plays saxophone, sings, and composes too. That's Kelly playing her song Every Road I Walk in the background. And before we go today, Frank DeFord on the underbelly of our national pastime. We talk with him about his new book, The Entitled. You're listening to Here and Now. The mountainous, rugged tribal region between Pakistan and Afghanistan has provided a sanctuary for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Western governments would like to find ways to, in effect, tame the region. Now the Bush administration is considering spending more than $450 million to build roads there and schools in an effort to expand its presence. Former mountain climber Greg Mortensen knows a lot about that part of the world and how to offer young people an alternative to religious extremism. His book, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace One School at a Time has been at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year. Its popularity has fueled Mortensen's Central Asia Institute, which has built 64 schools on the Afghan-Pakistan border over the past 15 years. Earlier this week, more than 1,000 people gathered in Belmont, Massachusetts, to hear Mortensen share his story about promoting literacy. Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyeroff caught up with Mortensen at the event. He told her that he's excited about the government's plan to expand education funding in the tribal areas, but he cautioned that previous U.S. efforts there have had limited success.
I can give you an example. About 6-7 years ago, the U.S. spent $18 million to refurbish 147 schools in Waziristan in the tribal areas of Pakistan. Only 8 schools were ever refurbished. But the main reason that I gleaned from talking with Akram Durrani, who was one of the leaders of the MMA party in Pakistan, he said that it wasn't community-based. The people were never involved. They brought in outside contractors. And so that, you know, might be good to dump a lot of money in there, but unless there's changes in the policy, I don't think really much will change from that.
So for all that money, they were only able to refurbish 8 schools. How much does it cost to build a school that the Central Asia Institute puts together?
Our schools cost from $15,000 to $25,000. The same identical school built with the same materials will cost the Pakistan government $60,000 to $80,000. A World Bank fund for the same school would probably be about $200,000.
Well, in the remote mountain areas in Pakistan where you've built many schools, this usually requires foreigners to travel with a Pakistani military escort. I know you don't always travel like that. But because of this, the U.S. money that they're looking at sending over there is earmarked for schools that would be built through USAID contractors who have greater access to the area. How might they be received?
From day one, they need to work with regional representatives and also set up provincial-based initiatives rather than doing everything from Islamabad or from a central kind of bureaucratic type of endeavor. One needs to look back at the Marshall Plan after World War II. The architects who designed it were genius, and it was a brilliant plan. It worked because it was decentralized and provincialized. Italy and Japan are good examples. Looking at the Marshall Plan, I'd say the current policy is completely backwards and reverse of the Marshall Plan. It's centralized and deprovincialized in multi-ethnic, pluralistic, you know, type of societies. And unless the local provincial leaders are involved, little will happen out in the rural areas where there's the most problem and also the highest illiteracy rate.
And that's how you've done it over the years, building relationships with tribal leaders, letting them get to know you, taking time to get to know their needs. And how has that worked?
We've been very successful. All our schools are thriving. We have enrollment is going up very fast. One of our schools we started last year, it was a village called Chunda in Pakistan, 74 girls in school the first day. It took us 8 years to get those girls to go to school the first day. This spring, in one more week, in March, we'll have 340 girls going to school there. I've been in 140 cities over the last year. I've talked to maybe 80,000 people, and I asked this one simple question. How many of you know the fact that in Afghanistan today there are 5.5 million kids in school, 1.8 million are female, and in 2000, during the Taliban heyday, there were only 800,000 kids in school. And I've only had 35 hands come up out of about 80,000 people. Now, to me, that's the single most inspiring, incredible news to come out of Afghanistan, and to me, that's really where we should look for hope for the future.
Greg Mortensen, thank you very much for speaking with Here and Now.
Thank you. Can I just add one more thing? As a child in Africa, I learned a proverb. If you educate a boy, you educate an individual. But if you educate a girl, you educate a community. And I really think the most important thing that can be done now is to really promote girls' education and female literacy.
Greg Mortensen, former climber, now school builder in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and author of the best-selling book, Three Cups of Tea. He spoke with Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyeroff. Coming up, sports writer Frank DeFord on Here and Now. For those of you out there who are winter weary, we understand. Here in Boston, we're expecting another winter storm tonight, but take heart. It might still be winter where you are, but spring training is underway and those boys of summer are getting ready to play baseball. So we thought we'd revisit a conversation we had about our national pastime with a longtime lover of the game, Frank DeFord. His novel, The Entitled, A Tale of Modern Baseball, comes out in paperback tomorrow. It tells the story of an old-time manager and his superstar outfielder. Howie Traveler never made it as a player, but he's the kind of manager who breathes baseball and who understands the tiny details of the game better than anyone. He's a natural. Jay Alcazar is also a natural, a superb hitter with endless talent, privilege, and the reputation as the best player in the game. The Entitled tells a story about their relationship, a rape allegation, and modern baseball. Frank DeFord is a six-time National Sports Writer of the Year and, of course, well-known to NPR listeners for his weekly commentaries on Morning Edition. I asked him about the novel's vivid characters, who we suspected came from his years of experience covering baseball.
Oh, yeah. They're both, neither one of them is based one-to-one on anybody because that wouldn't be any fun. But they're composite of people that I've known, and not just in baseball, but in all sports through the years.
Hmm. Well, talk about the first protagonist, the old manager, Howie Traveler. He never made it as a player, but he's a great manager.
These are guys like the NCOs in the Army who really make the Army work as much as anything else, even though they aren't the generals. And Howie has just adored baseball, never very good at it himself, good enough to play in the minor leagues and to get, as they say, a cup of coffee in the majors, but has hung on, and it's cost him. This love has cost him. It's cost him much of his family. It's cost him a chance to do anything else, but he has finally arrived at the top. He's a manager of a major league team.
And Howie Traveler, you tell us in the book, he knows which way the ball is going to bounce off a broken bat, whether a player wears his pants high or low. He's a manager who sometimes ignores statistics and numbers and goes with his gut. Are you thinking about him as sort of a dying breed? Because there's something wistful in your description of him.
Yeah, he is. I think Howie is sort of represents old-time baseball and the way that it used to be and the way that he wants players all to wear their pants right and to do things right and to honor the game and not just make a buck from it. Mm. Howie loves baseball, I suppose, more than he even understands it.
Now, standing in contrast to Howie is the other main character in the book for whom The Entitled is named, Jay Alcazar. And I'm wondering, there's a passage on page 112 that I wanted you to read, if you could. It's that graph that begins, Alcazar looked at it this way. It sort of talks about his sense of entitlement.
Delighted. Here we go. Alcazar looked at it this way. Most of the retinue that surrounded him was there to serve him. His agent Montague, first of all, and Brenda, Montague's secretary, who answered all his mail and dutifully reminded him of obligations and birthdays. The team's public relations people, Doug E. Flint, was especially good at making sure that different girlfriends were separated from each other at the home games, not to mention Flint's even trickier task of separating the seats for the girlfriends and the wives of the married players. Then there were Alcazar's reps at Louisville Slugger and Nike, the Indian coaches and doctors and trainers, your every medical whim immediately attended to, plus massages, the equipment guys, the clubhouse guys, everything your heart desires, food and drink, batteries for your appliances, charging for your cell phones. The best attendants even had Mother's and Father's Day cards stamped, you understand, available in May and June, because who could expect big leaguers to remember such a thing themselves, let alone actually purchase Hallmarks?
It's the way it is, right?
It's the way it is.
Yeah. What is the effect on the game? I mean, these players clearly deserve the money they make in the sense that the business is making the money, but but is there something corrosive about this enormous sense of entitlement?
I don't think that it hurts the game as much as it hurts the players as people. I think that when the game starts, and I'm always sort of sentimental about this, I believe that almost all players forget how much money they do have, and their just instinctive athletic sense comes in, and they go out there and they play. I mean, you see guys diving into the stands after balls and risking life and limb. But I do think that what this sense of entitlement does, it wounds them terribly as human beings and gives them a sense of privilege that hurts them in their private lives.
Hmm. Let's talk about the central conflict and action in this story. It revolves around an allegation of date rape against the star player Jay Alcazar. And we're not giving anything away here because this is all laid out early in the book. And it's about what Howie Traveler, the old manager, saw one night in the hotel where the team was staying.
Yeah, Howie sees something which would strengthen the woman's story much more. I mean, this is obviously one of those classic he said, she said situations, and Howie knows that if he reports what he saw to the police, that it's going to give her much more credibility than exists right now. And so it's an ethical conundrum for Howie as well as a professional one, because he knows very well that if he damages the star, it's going to ruin him as a player and maybe even put him behind bars in the extreme. And so he's caught up in a very difficult situation.
And it's never entirely clear, at least it wasn't to me, exactly what happened. And it seems you make an effort to paint Jay as a sympathetic figure.
Well, my thinking was very clear. If I made Jay to be a dumb jock and altogether greedy and altogether selfish, then you weren't going to like him. And you certainly weren't going to believe him when he said that he didn't rape the woman. It was important that he not only be attractive and stylish and bright, but that he be wrestling with the whole issue of entitlement and what it means to him.
Mm. It seems like the tension between these two guys, the old manager and his star outfielder, sort of represents that tension between traditional baseball and of modern baseball. I mean, of something that we're losing and something that the game has come to be increasingly.
Oh, yeah. They come from opposite poles, not only in the fact that Howie wasn't any good as a player and Jay is the best, but they're different generations. They're different races. One is a white-bred Midwesterner, and the other one is a Latin American. And beyond that, Jay has come from a very wealthy background. So these guys are just absolutely at different poles, which makes the relationship interesting because I won't go into it, but the relationship does grow and it does develop. And by the end, there's not only a mutual regard for one another, but even a certain amount of affection, which, of course, makes it even more difficult for Howie when he has to decide what to do, whether he should go to the police or not.
Mm. You've been a sports writer for a long time, and I'm just wondering how your view of this game has changed, your appreciation of the game, because it seems like in this book there are sort of two versions of what Frank DeFord might think of this game.
Yeah, I even have an old jaded, cynical newspaper man named Mickey Huey, who's sort of a Greek chorus.
Oh, I loved him. He was great. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of me in there.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of me in Mickey. There's a little bit of me in, but there's a little bit of me in Howie, too.
Hmm. But say more about Mickey, because actually I was going to ask you specifically. I said, I think there's a little self-portrait going on there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I do think that people like Mickey Huey, who've been around the game, come to hate it, just become so put off by all that happens that they don't see the beauty and the glory of the game anymore. And he wants to love the game the way he did when he was a kid. And he says, when I was a kid, I just loved it so much and loved the chance to be a sports writer. And now he just sees all the how tarnished it is. And I think I'm that way, too. I have seen, if you're around sports all the time, you see the underside of it. You know, you see the dirt. On the other hand, I think its beauty and its grace still shines through for me most of the time. I can be terribly, terribly sentimental about sports and about baseball most of all, because I think it's our most sentimental sport.
That's author and longtime sports writer Frank DeFord. His book, The Entitled, A Tale of Modern Baseball, comes out in paperback tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Robin Young will be back Monday. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.